Welcome, Vicki. Can you state your name and affiliation, please, and proceed?
My name is Vicki Wallner. I'm founder of Stop Valley Thieves. I'm also a co-coordinator for Neighborhood Watch Program and a member of the Massive Crime Stoppers Board, as well as a member of the Last State Trooper Citizens Academy. I founded Stop Valley Thieves in 2013 for a few friends of mine and to help raise awareness of any burglaries, suspicious activities occurring, just to help people raise awareness for people, and also to help people look for their stolen items. They post pictures. Right now we have, I think, 10,400 members in our group. And I've spent a lot of time working with the victims and citizens in the community regarding the property crime, which leads into the drug problem. And as I've done that, one of the things that has really shocked me is the amount of anger and frustration and disgust that people have towards this criminal justice system, which they feel like is not representing the victim at all. Right now, what I see that people want the most is they want justice. And that's almost a bad word to say by itself anymore. People, you have to use restorative justice or smart justice. When you say justice, people think of dungeons or something. And that's not what people want. They want people to do the time for the crime. And that's not happening. And it boots on the ground, on the street. We see it every single day, these people rotating in and out of the system. Every day. And they continue to commit more crimes. When we're talking about early release, I don't think that the public really has a problem with when someone has done their time, they get off for good behavior, whatever, or they go to a rehab program. But the first thing that needs to happen is they need to go into a hard bed, and that's not what's happening. And I can show you case after case of that not happening. I want to pick out just a couple. One of them is Robert Crowley. He was arrested back in 2012 on theft and, I believe, drug charges. Convicted of felony, both felonies, and then was charged with another felony that following year. And while he was out on those, he was charged and convicted of several more felony thefts, vehicle thefts, theft of watercraft, altogether. When he was picked up and charged in 2013, he had uh, 25 charges against him. And as the DA normally does, they ended up bundling most of those charges, and he got convicted of one felony, one or two felonies on that. I was with the victim at to give a victim impact statement. When he was sentenced, well, I guess he was sentenced trying to read my notes. Helps if I put my glasses on. He was sentenced on 9/10/2013, and he received 3 years. And the DA told the victim, well, he's already got 3 years on this other case, so he's going to be in for several years. 6 months later, this guy who gave the victim impact statement runs in to Mr. Crowley out on an ankle monitor. 6 months later. This guy's record goes back 10 years. Why is he out on an ankle monitor? When we complained, suddenly he was brought in from the ankle monitor. Since then, I think he's violated probation several times. and he is back out on probation again. But that's an example of someone who in two cases together, one right after the other, was given 6 years, and 6 months he's out on an ankle monitor. And this person, I mean, as you can see, 25 charges, that's too much. Then we have the case of William Beasley. Some of you may know Mr. Beasley. He is the one that robbed Miller's Market at gunpoint. Now, Mr. Beasley had an extensive juvenile record and also had several offenses before that offense occurred. He robbed a 16-year-old girl at gunpoint. Trying to find my note on him here. And he was, went into the pretrial, was let out on bail to his grandfather, and he pretty much remained with his grandfather until he was sentenced, I believe, on 5/18 of 2015 for armed robbery, convicted of armed robbery. In September, Mr. Beasley was out on an ankle monitor. He was sentenced to 66 months in jail. Actually more, 66. It was reduced down to 66, 10 years probation. 66 months. And less than 6 months later, he's walking around on an ankle monitor in the same community that he robbed at gunpoint. Now, the commissioner can say what he's saying, but my understanding and what I have seen is anybody with less than 5 years to 3 years to serve, if they can afford an ankle monitor, they're out the door. And Mr. Beasley's family can't afford an ankle monitor, and they did pay for one. Now, Mr. Beasley is back in pretrial after 2 months of being out, only for the reason that he was brought in on a warrant from Anchorage on another case where he failed to do community service. But let me talk about being on an ankle monitor. Because
can you hold on a second, Vicki, so we can kind of drill into this? So armed robbery, convicted of, had a previous history, convicted of armed robbery, sentenced to 6 years in May.
66. He was sentenced to, I believe, 96 months with some sentence of 66 months to serve.
66 months to serve.
Yes.
And 4 months later, he's released and on an ankle monitor. Now, how did you know that? Was the victim notified?
I believe the victim was notified, but she was going away to college, so it wasn't that, you know, I mean, her mother's pretty upset,
okay.
But she's not a...
So the other kind of inconsistency that we've heard you just said, you said that the victim's family paid for the electronic monitoring, and corrections testified when they're in the custody of corrections, that's paid for and monitored by Department of Corrections, and the pretrial is different from that. But this is, sounds like it was implementation of the sentence and released on ankle monitor under the supervision of the parole office of the Department of Corrections. So why would, maybe we have to check that fact, but I don't think they would pay for that.
I thought that people let out of Department of Corrections had to pay for their monitors.
Okay, well, we need to follow up on that because I don't think so. The other thing is what we've heard, and this has been the soundbite, if you will, of the department, is that, well, we won't release violent offenders. Well, I think an armed robbery is a violent offense, and that's not adding up. So please continue.
Doesn't add up for us either. While he was out on the ankle monitor for 2 months before he was rearrested, he posted pictures on Facebook of his favorite guns. He also posted pictures of Duke Luke, we are so high, in a picture of marijuana leaf. This is a guy that didn't even serve a year in a hard bed for armed robbery. How does that happen? How does that even happen? And this is why people are so angry. We're seeing people that are convicted of vehicle thefts, of burglary, and these people are walking back out on the street within a year. And that is not justice for these victims. And sometimes the only justice they get is when someone goes to jail, because they don't get their stuff back. They don't get their sense of security and their homes back. You know, and the anger that I see with people is because they don't feel like anyone cares. These people get arrested over and over and over again. And the reality on the streets is that these misdemeanors that we're filling our jails up with, these are not first-time offenders. And the huge amount of people in pretrial, these people are there because I think their families finally got sick of bailing them out. Because I know a lot of those people that are in pretrial and have been there for a while, and their families are like, we're done. We're done bailing them out. Because they either get off on the charges or the charges get reduced. They don't get help. They don't get rehab. They go right back out on the street, and while they're hugging their mom and dad, they're reaching behind them with their hand and slipping money out of the purse. And that's the way it works with drug addicts. The bottom line, and this is what I have seen works with drug addicts, is because we're dealing with heroin and meth, and they're using property crimes to support those habits, is that we're paying to send these people to rehab over and over and over again with little to no results because the people didn't want to be there to begin with. That is a get-out-of-jail card free for them. And we have people and families that want to put their kids in rehab, but there's no beds because we're filling them up with people from corrections that are mandated into rehab. And my experience in dealing with addicts and friends' experience in dealing with their kids is that the ones I have seen be successful are the ones that spent a year in jail for the simple reason by the end of that year they've got some brain cells connecting. When we rotate them through the jail system and we put them right back out the door, they're gaming them just like they're gaming their families. They know that's how the system works, and they're using that to their advantage. I think it's at the point that people are just sick and tired of feeling like, you know, I read through this entire recidivism reduction plan. I found the front of it very interesting, and the fact that there's all these people in the circle. Who's not in the circle? We aren't. We're standing at the door along with tribal organizations. And it says right on the front here, there's a quote from George W. Bush that says this country was built on the belief that each human being has limitless potential and worth. Everybody matters. We believe that even those that have struggled with a dark past to find brighter days ahead, one day, one way, we act on that belief is by helping former prisoners who've paid for their crimes. Key words there. These people aren't paying for their crimes. They aren't staying in jail long enough to pay for their crimes. And I don't think many of the victims in this community feel any sort of justice. They're being re-victimized by the system when they watch these people walk right back out the door from pretrial, and then they may go on to commit several more offenses before they're finally rearrested again. It's 2 years before they finally get sentenced. If you look at the cases deposed by the DA's office, you'll see people in there who have multiple charges. The DA only convicts them of one. They don't convict them of multiples, and sometimes entire cases get dismissed. And it's because the DAs are overwhelmed, you know. And we talk about recidivism, but I think we're causing part of that recidivism by not dealing with it. You know, first-time offenders, yes, I think everybody deserves a chance. But when someone's offended two or three times and they're still not serving time in a hard bed, we put them back out the door. Well, what do? They reoffend. Now we've got recidivism. So we have to do something to stop this process. And I can tell you right now, members of this community are incredible. They have ideas of ways to make things work, but nobody ever asks them. They're making these plans, but we're not a part of it. You know, we're dealing now with all the people that they're rotating through the system very quickly, and now they're talking, and, you know, people are just at the point that they're feeling overwhelmed by some of this, and yet now we're going to dump a whole bunch more on them, and we're not going to give us any say in it. And who's going to pay the price? We are.
Vicki, we've kind of had a lot of conversation today about pretrial offenses. Can you kind of relate for us your observations on reoffenses or other offenses committed during that pretrial period while an inmate or a defendant is on bail with electronic monitor, some specific cases or...
I'll give you one more
the
metro.
Is, you know, and then is it a threat to the community the way it's being handled right now?
In pretrial, absolutely. Wyatt Metro, arrested 1 week. Within a week, he's in a 100-mile-an-hour chase with the state troopers. I could bring more cases that these people are reoffending within a week. Vinny Iacovelli, another one, within a week. He wasn't even out 3 days, and he reoffended. And the people, the citizens, we know this is happening.
Are they cutting them off, or they're not properly monitored?
They just let them out on bail. They don't necessarily put them on ankle monitors.
Okay.
Some of them are on ankle monitors, but it's really hard to tell who's on ankle monitors and who's not on ankle monitors from the information that we can get as the public. We have to, with the Department of Corrections, we have to look up each individual offender through Vine to see if that offender is incarcerated or still on an ankle monitor, to try to follow whether someone is incarcerated or rehab or whatever through court view is impossible.
Okay, do we need reform on public notice, better public notice for cases pre-trial, during trial, during sentence, during incarceration, post-incarceration, parole? Can you kind of comment on that for us?
I think one of the biggest handicaps that we've had as a group is that the court system decided to take off the sentencing information onto court view. So we don't know what a person is sentenced to. And so if we see that person on the street 6 months later, we may know if the charge, they were convicted of a Class C felony, but we don't know the particulars of what the judge decided. My understanding is 1 to 3 minimum for a Class C felony. And if they're a repeat offender, longer. But the thing of it is that that's not what we're seeing. And to go in and try to see, was this person, how much time did they serve, is an extensive effort. And we went today to try to get the sentencing records of some of the offenders I wanted to talk to today. And even the clerk of court has got to go back, get the files, bring all the files out, and then we have to go through each one of them. That's ridiculous. That's ridiculous. And the thing of it is when you look at court view, and I've got one example here, they list every single motion, the date it was filed, whether it was accepted, whether this charging document, who the attorney is. The one sentence they don't put in there is what they were sentenced to. I can't help but believe that that's deliberate. When we started, you know, reporting about lenient sentences and stuff like that, then suddenly they decided their budget was cut too much and they couldn't put the sentencing information on there. But like with Crawley, I've got 2 pages of motions and hearings and everything else, but we don't have the one part that shows what the judge sentenced them to. I think that's a handicap. I think it's a handicap for us to have to constantly, when somebody gets arrested, you know, everybody has a right to bail. We all understand that. But to see someone who's been arrested several times in the last 2-3 months, you know, get arrested again and then go right back out on the street, this is where people are just at the point that they're getting so frustrated that, you know, the last thing we want, and we emphasize on our page, is it's vigilance, not vigilante. And we have banned people off our page that want to talk like that. That doesn't work for us. We believe that we have to find better solutions. But, you know, we're getting people, the last thing we want is somebody to get shot. We don't want an innocent person shot. We don't want a criminal shot, okay? I mean, some people may feel differently, but, you know, it's getting to the point where we're going to release more inmates at the same time we're closing trooper detachments. You know, this is a recipe for disaster as far as I'm concerned. You're going to close trooper detachments, but we're going to release a lot more inmates. That makes no sense to me. And we're looking at, ultimately, I found it interesting when Commissioner Taylor talked about, you know, their target this year for electronic monitoring is an additional 176, which is the exact number of minimum beds at PCC. But yet we're not going to close down the one prison that we're paying the least amount to put a hard bed in. I think we've got to look at some other solutions. I think, why are we not doing rehab in prison? We're doing some of it, okay, but we've got our prisoners there. They're a captive audience. They're not going anywhere. But yet, a lot of this is being farmed out to rehabs and halfway houses. And I think it's mandatory that if we want to stop the recidivism, we have to get to them while they've got some brain cells connecting, because as soon as they get back out that door, most of them reoffend, 2 out of 3. We've only lowered it by 3%, what, in five, 6 years? That's not anything to brag about. And we've put, what, $250 million into the programs to try to help rehab them. And why should we, people that are working hard, doing the deal every day, are the ones being victimized and have to pay to send someone to rehab 12 times? That, I mean, people are just at the point they've had enough. And they don't feel like anybody's listening. So the ultimate end is going to be when something really bad happens, and it will. It's only a matter of time, you know. I don't want to see it happen. I'd like to see things, you know, the community input be given before something like that happens. I mean, we do have some good programs in place, but we have to expand those programs, and we have to really take a serious look at the people who were letting out of the door at DOC. If they have not done at least a year in a hard bed, that's to me. If they have a drug issue especially, when they go right back out on ankle monitor, and they're on an ankle monitor, they're on Facebook, they're posting pictures, you know, they're meeting up with their friends and stuff. Whenever Robert Crowley's, one of his victims, contacted me, Robert Crowley was on there, you know, he even posted a picture of himself with his ankle monitor on, you know, it's almost like proud. And he was not notified. He was registered through Vine, and he was not notified that Mr. Crowley was out until...
Vicki, we're going to have to wrap up here pretty quick. Senator Schultz has a question, and then maybe you can close.
Thanks, Representative Colbert. I think the Dispatch News, when they had an article a couple years ago, they called you the Online Neighborhood Watch, and that's I thought that was an apt title. I know there's other groups like the Kenai Peninsula Crime Group, and I want to go just focus on that, given that your incredible resource, you with 10,000, probably some less active than others, on that extra information that was that's no longer on the court views, the sentencing information, as a online neighborhood watch group with a probably a statewide reach, actually. How is it? Can you just dig in a little more how that information is useful for you as folks that are assisting the administration of justice? Is because that's sort of what community monitoring is. It's relies on a lot of elements. And how I want to just focus in on just that one issue of if you can just elaborate on the importance of that information, or if it's not that important.
Well, you know, for one, it's hard to for a citizen to look at the effectiveness of the system if we don't have all the information. When we look and we see people back on the streets that we know were just sentenced not too long ago, we can't tell, was their sentence all suspended? Were they sent to rehab? We can't, as citizens, expect to be part of this if we're handicapped with information. We can't tell what's working for us and what isn't if we don't have access to sentencing information.
I'd appreciate, as we're moving along and developing legislation, some of it I'll have to decide whether you try to make a bill that has problems. Do you make it better or do you try to not pass it? So we'll evaluate that as we're doing that. But I sure would appreciate continued input and on issues like that. It's all these things, I guess we call them amendments or aspects of a committee substitute. And this is very relevant discussion points. I think I brought it up earlier, and maybe you might have talked to me about it in the past, but I don't think I came up with that originally with my concern about that. So I appreciate being able to drill in on that. I know there was a lot of reluctance from the Department of Public Safety when we're dealing with primarily dealing with the Deputy Commissioner during the Knowles administration, putting that on until they decided to do it themselves, and then it was done with fanfare, and it's, I think it's been a very successful community monitoring program. I don't think there's a realtor that doesn't check in on that, or a prospective buyer, or the mother with kids. I mean, it's become a tool that doesn't require a lot of resources. And as long as we don't get into, and I appreciate that you've disavowed any association with vigilantism, it's just information, and that's the way this information ought to be used. So I appreciate that and look forward to your help in the future.
Thank you, Senator. Vicki, is there anything you want to, we're going to need you to stay tuned on this issue because it's this reform, I'm glad you're studying that report because we'll probably need you to weigh in and testimony on this legislation if you'd be available as we go through that evaluation process. So that was,
and alert the public.
And alert the public. I think the most important thing, and I think for all of you here, part of this exercise today is letting the public know what's going on. I mean, and I think the most valuable role that you have taken your own time is to educate us as policy setters and public, let us know. And you're right. People want justice. People feel helpless. That we have, you know, a $9 billion budget and we can't hold the criminals accountable. We've got to do a better job. So if there's any closing comments you might have, then we'll have Michelle Overstreet up here on how we're trying to improve the recidivism rate in our community.
And I want to say that My House is an excellent program, and that's one example of the community stepping up to the plate. But I want to mention that in the Senate subcommittee, the House subcommittee hearing on corrections on 2/29/15, Commissioner Taylor stated, "The public needs to understand that there will be an acceptable level of risk that's going to rise." And, you know, to me, to hear that, we feel like we're already at an acceptable level of risk. And to be looking at increasing that is very concerning to me, and especially as the public has no input into that process. So I just want to thank you for inviting me in. I just want to thank you for paying attention to what is going on the streets, because it looks different on the streets than it looks from there, than it looks from DOC. It looks different to the people who are actually living it every day.
Thank you, Vicki. We really appreciate your commitment and look forward to working with you.
Thanks.
Michelle, would you come forward, please? Leonard, introduce yourself and your affiliation, please.
Hi, I'm Michelle Overstreet, and I'm the executive director and founder of My House. Do you have any questions that you want me to start out with?
Well, you specifically wanted to get some information on, you have a pilot program, if you will, to deal with the high percentage of homelessness of inmates as they're released, and you're specifically, as I understand, targeting 18 to 24-year-olds to try to get them on a life path away from a life of crime. And then maybe just a brief, for the rest of us here, what My House is in this community, is homeless teens and getting them productive. Maybe just a brief description of the overall mission of my house, and then specifically this endeavor you're on to segue inmates back into society.
Okay. My house is a nonprofit that services youth age 14 to 24. We provide food, clothing, showers, laundry, housing, jobs. We have a network of service providers to support self-sufficiency, and that includes mental health services, substance abuse, life skills, counseling in general, domestic violence recovery and support, sexual assault team member for recovering from a lot of those kinds of situations. We run two for-profit businesses that train and employ homeless youth. As part of our business model, in an effort to be independent of Medicaid and Medicare, we're one of the only nonprofits that provides case management without a dependency on Medicaid or Medicare. And that's why you always see us in the news doing fundraisers, because we're raising money all the time to keep that going. Our goal with our prisoner reentry program, and I want to give a shout out to Corrections, because we've met with Ron Taylor, we've met with Special Assistant Phil Cole, and a number of people that are involved in corrections. We have POs and COs that call us from Goose Creek when somebody's getting ready to be released. So we know who's coming. We know if they have special needs. For example, we had a young man who joined us 3 or 4 months ago, and he had a special medical condition that required some food supplements, and it allowed us to get some things in place to keep that situation under control. So the communication is working well with corrections. Our success rate, I think, has been phenomenal. Of the young men who have gone into our housing, in 2 years' time, nobody has gone back to jail. So I don't know the exact number of youth that we've had, but we have a twice convicted felon on drug charges who has over a year clean and sober, finished his high school diploma, finished two training programs with Northern Industrial Training, and has a great job right now. And he will never go back to jail. He is done. That's not part of his lifestyle. And I think we need to kind of keep in mind, I feel like there's been a separation, an us and them kind of separation, just in hearing some of the questions. And I think we have to keep in mind that nobody wants to grow up to be a criminal. Nobody sets that goal. You know, they want to grow up and be firemen, and they want to be policemen. They don't want to grow up to be a criminal. And with that in mind, when we're putting pieces in place, the victorious triad for prisoner reentry is housing. If they go back to being homeless and they have a drug issue, they will go back to sleeping on the heroin dealer's couch, dealing for the dealer, and eventually using. And interesting, when Vicki was talking, 3 out of the 4 names that she mentioned, and I've got a master's degree in 25 years of doing drug treatment in Alaska. 3 out of 4 of the names that she mentioned of specific individuals, I recognize from being involved in substance abuse recovery treatment with juveniles. So those were people that had drug problems as juveniles, and I see their names today in the paper as adult criminals, and it's very clear to me that those are drug-related. So yeah, housing
just a
is...
a second there. So a lot of this, these problems are driven by drug addicts not getting treatment, and then
no question.
And then the issue that you've targeted is there's a high percentage, and I think Commissioner of Public Safety spoke to it. L.A. They put a lot of folks out, and they became the homeless population. So this, you have identified that the homeless population in Alaska, a large percentage, are inmates recently released, and that's what you're trying to, you're working with a population that you're trying to move into a productive part of society.
That's exactly correct. And the demographic we're dealing with, that 18 to 24-year-old, has a high recidivism rate, partly because when they do come out of jail, they may not have a high school diploma, they don't have job skills. It's hard to get housing if you can't get a job. So the victorious triad for people coming out of jail is housing, jobs, and recovery choices. If we can stabilize them in housing, and our goal when we have guys coming out of Goose Creek is to have them in housing within 24 hours. And I should speak to this for a minute. Our housing is not supervised 24 hours a day. They're on their own. However, they are required to pay rent. Everybody pays. It is not free. Everybody has to have a job. If you don't have one when you move in or when you first get out of jail, you have to have it within 30 days of moving in. You have to stay clean and sober, and we reserve the right to test at any time. If you test positive, you're not immediately kicked out. You have the opportunity to go to treatment. Of course, if it's a probation violation for them, then we work with their POs and COs to try to make arrangements for a different kind of housing or an inpatient treatment program. And one of the things that Alaska is severely lacking, in the Valley in particular, is detox and treatment. It's very, very difficult to get anybody into treatment if they don't already have an established relationship with a treatment provider.
Can you comment on Vicki's comment that that we should be doing rehab in the prisons before they're released, why they have that one-year period or whatever the sentence is, as far as more effective in rehabilitating addicts so they're not reoffending and getting back into the cycle of crime?
I totally agree with that, but I think that there's that we not only need rehab in this. Right now, our jails are acting as detox centers and treatment centers, and we're incarcerating people in order to achieve an end that it's not designed to achieve. So if we really want to address the substance abuse issues that people that are incarcerated have, we can start the process of sobriety while they're in prison, but there needs to be a continuity that goes once they're out of prison, so that they maintain that sobriety and they have support for that. And here's how we're doing this at my house. So they have housing that requires them to be sober. They have a job. We have two businesses on site. We can put them to work right there. One of the reasons that I have challenges with every single thing about their legal history being posted in CourtView is that I'm trying to help kids that are age 19. Let's say I've got, I have a 19-year-old who has two felony drug convictions. And if I'm trying to help him get a job, he doesn't yet have a high school diploma, he doesn't have a lot of job training, I'm trying to help him get a job, and everybody he's applying with court views, and they can see that he's served one part of his sentence, but he's got to go back and serve another one. They don't want to hire him because they don't want him to have to quit to go serve the other half of his sentence. So he can't get a job, and without a job, he can't get housing. And so we've got some conundrums here within that are built into the system, and there are reasons that we don't post every aspect of that legal situation for some of the people that are coming out of that. And again, these are guys that don't want to be criminals. They might have an addiction problem. Maybe they made a stupid choice when they were 18, 19, 20. And I'm not sure that we should punish them for, you know, the rest of their lives as a result of that. I think if they can demonstrate that they can make good choices, then there needs to be some recovery offered there. The recovery, so housing, jobs, and just as an aside, our partnership with Nine Star, which is an employability nonprofit in Anchorage, is critical within our building, because when we have clients come in, they can get a job right there. They get help with their resume. If they've got a charge that's against them, a legal history or incarceration, we help them write a cover letter that explains, this is the situation I was in, this is what my mindset was, I'm not that guy anymore, so that they do have a better opportunity to get jobs. Nine Star and my house also partnered for over $88,000 in training that happened right over here at NIT for recovering prisoners since January of this year. We're putting guys into training programs at NIT that make it unnecessary for them to deal drugs, that make them proud and not want to go back to doing that. So it's really, really important that we put that foundation under them. Same thing with the treatment. The treatment has to happen. If we can get the continuity from incarceration and out into the community, so that we have partnerships with two different treatment facilities that actually come on site to do evaluations. And if somebody fails a drug test in our housing, I just had this happen this week. If somebody fails a drug test and they're already in a treatment program with Aquila House, for example, we have a release of information to call Aquila House and say, hey, we got a positive test from this person. We know that they're in treatment. They're struggling. Is there a way that we can increase the intensity of their treatment? Can they go to inpatient treatment? Because we can't keep them in our housing. And most of the time, those are kids that are still holding their jobs. They're still following the rules. They're not going back to jail. They just relapse, and they need a more intense mode of treatment. So it becomes really important to have that relationship and that communication, not just with corrections, but with the recovery facilities. And then the support groups, we have AA and NA groups that happen right in our building. and the sober housing. We can't just put them in an apartment. If they're in the Palmer Arms over here, and no offense to anybody from Palmer, but if we put them in an apartment in the Palmer Arms and they're at a risk for relapse, that's a high-risk environment. I hope that you will listen to Teria Walters. She's on the list for persons to be heard, and she needs more time than 3 minutes to tell you her story. The information that she will share is both relevant and powerful. I feel like there are times when we're in public situations like this where we put people who have been incarcerated on one side of the room, and we sit on the other side of the room and try to make decisions for what should happen. And I think we need to start asking questions of people who have been incarcerated and experienced what we're talking about, and offer them the opportunity to be part of the solution, because they have powerful and directive information that has the ability to change the course of our community. The challenges for us at my house are that continuing to incarcerate people perpetuates a culture of dependence. That they come out from that and they don't have that mojo of getting productive and being in recovery and being part of a healthy community. We have a young man who was incarcerated for 2 years, and it took us about a month to get him just in the mode of feeling empowered to do anything. And he was being trained in our cafe, so he was right there on site. But it changes their ability to engage in being a member of a community and a member of our society. And I think that has to be part of the prisoner recovery program, is that we have to start saying, you know, these are not those people over there. These are community members that are valued and that have great potential, especially in that younger age group that we're working at. We feel really strongly that they can recover, and they will recover and become productive citizens. And that's how we reduce the long-term numbers for corrections.
Thank you, Michelle. Good job. And look forward to more information on this and some statistics, if you could provide us with, on how many folks and how long they stayed and where they're at now, so that we can kind of have a benchmark, as maybe use this as a model, helping people get back on their feet and be living productive lives.
Thank you. I know that right now we're the only organization in the Valley providing that service, period. And it only goes up to 24. So if they're over 24, they have none.
Senator Stoltz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to give you like a 30-second advertising opportunity for some of the private and fundraising initiatives you do. We're filming right now.
Oh, gosh, that's so sweet. Well, one thing that we have coming up that I would let everybody know about is on Friday the 13th of November, we have a 12-hour radio marathon with KMBQ. And we have youth recording testimonies right now. People who support us are welcome to come and speak on the radio and just talk about what you see the value of our organization as being in the community, you know, how you've seen the outcomes. We are not an organization that counts heads. I can tell you that we've screened over 260 homeless kids in the last 2 years, but what I really would like to tell you is about the number that we've trained at NIT, the number that have finished their high school diploma. This year in the cafe, we had 5 kids employed in the cafe in August. And when college started, 4 of them went to college. And I will tell you that I have never been more proud than to have 3 homeless kids head out for it. 2 of them went to Fairbanks and 1 went back to Mat-Su. And that changes our community. That changes everything about the perception of a homeless kid in our valley. And again, thank you for giving me the shout out for the fundraising. I would like to say to all of you that one of the things that I see from a fundraising perspective is that we have a lot of grant funds that pay the same organizations year after year after year for a revolving door where nobody ever gets well. And we have to start focusing on outcomes and saying, as a community, we're going to pay organizations to get people well and get them back on their feet. And if they can't do that, then they no longer qualify for the funding. That's a setup, because Medicaid does that to some extent. You bill Medicaid, and you bill every time they come in. So as a psychologist at the hospital, they would say, as many clients as you can get for as long as you can keep them, because that keeps the money rolling in. That is not the best thing for our community. And so the system is broken in that way. And when you're talking about grants and looking at grant funding, if you would please keep in the back of your mind We want to know what the outcome of this is. If you've been working on domestic violence or even substance abuse for 20 years and the numbers in the Valley continue to increase, then let's look at somebody else who might be able to do a better job with that money. Thank you.
I'll just throw out, I was at a Matsu Miners baseball game. It was NIT night, and I invited the Senator Sullivan's chief of staff to come out, and I bought him a coupon. He won the car detailing, and I think that's a freebie for you, because I think his car's in Bethesda, Maryland.
Oh, how great is that? I forgot to mention that Cardeets is one of our partners, and they employ and train our kids as well, our homeless kids. Thank you for that. We do a lot of fundraising because it's how we keep our doors open. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Michelle. So we'll have... We're going to roll into public testimony. Ms. Overstreet mentioned Tarek Walters had a story to tell her. Is she here? Go ahead. Come on up.
Sorry, it's kind of going to be a little bit emotional.
Sure, go ahead and just state your name and then proceed.
My name is Terry.
If you need a minute, you can just go ahead and stop.
My name is Terry Walters, and I'm the mother of Christopher Seaman, the young man that was murdered. And Joshua Beebe is the individual that has been accused of that. And I'm also a person in long-term recovery. I have over 10 years clean and sober. And I'll tell you a little bit about my own experience as somebody that has been in the system for many, many years. At the age of 11, I was put in the system in foster care in Fairbanks, Alaska, because I was in a home that was extremely abusive and had addiction, alcohol and drugs within it. And then I ended up getting in trouble, and at the age of 14, I was placed in Fairbanks Youth Facility on a 2-year sentence for not following the conditions of my probation. I had stolen a truck when I was on the run. And so I ended up getting out, and then my major issue that I had dealt with for years and years was addiction. And it went on to my adult years, and I've been in and out of the system since I became an adult. And I'm a 2-time felon, and my last felony charge that I got was a drug offense, which I was sentenced to 20 years with 8 suspended. Before that happened, I tried many, many times within Anchorage and the Valley to get help for my addiction issue. Even took myself to emergency rooms trying to get detoxed off of heroin, which started with pain pills. A doctor prescribed me OxyContin and methadone, and then I progressed into full-blown heroin addiction. What I have found that because I've been in the system and I am a recovering addict myself, I did not have many options for detox services and treatment. And I say treatment, I'm talking long-term treatment, not 28 days, not 60 days, not 90 days. I'm talking 12 to 24 months treatment. I didn't have many resources, and I'll tell you that I have supported my drug habit through prostitution. I didn't really hold a job down. I didn't really know much about holding a job down because I sold drugs, and I also prostituted to support my drug habit. While incarcerated, I was given the opportunity to do treatment because I had such a long prison sentence, which a lot of people do not have that opportunity because of limited beds within the system, within the prison. 28 beds within Highland Mountain Correctional Center. I completed the RSAT program, which was 14 months. I did that, and then I also petitioned the Alaska Correctional Ministries to get a female's TLC program, which is very high success rate within the women's prison, and I completed that also, and I did 12 months of that. So altogether, I did 26 months of inpatient treatment. And why did I do that? Because I had the time to do it. Not many people have that option. We're talking, when I had this long prison sentence, I'm dealing with individuals that are in there, most of them are in there on drug offenses or drug-related offenses that are not getting the treatment that they need. They are getting out, they get a low-level sentence a year for possession, and then they are living within the facility because they got 8 months with good time. They get let out, and they go right back to doing what they do. And not only once the sentence is completed, they get back let back out, and I'll tell you from my own experience, I did over 5 years and was released by the parole board. I'm still on parole, and I got 5 months left, and I'm still sober. My son was murdered 3 months ago, and I'm still sober. I had many obstacles that I faced when I walked out those doors. My sentence didn't end, and I'll tell you, it has a lot to do with barriers that have been set up. Because I'm a drug offender, I cannot get food stamps, I cannot get housing, I cannot get any form of educational services, federal educational services. And I lived in transitional housing and renting rooms by posting ads on Craigslist, revealing everything about myself, hoping that somebody would rent a room to me. Just last year, I was able to get somebody to rent to me after 4 years, and I've been there almost two. Well, I've been there since February of last year, so about a year and a half. When I first got out, the first job that I got was 20 hours. Nobody wanted to hire me. Eventually, I ended up getting one after I passed a background check. And I started out at $9.40 an hour, and I rented a room for $400 a month. And I ate ramen noodles, macaroni and cheese, and sandwiches. I fully support what the Commissioner and Department of Corrections is doing. And the reason why I say that is because I have lived within the system, and I see many, many individuals that could benefit from getting on the ankle monitor. And we're talking individuals that have fines and restitution that they have to pay. If an individual gets out on ankle monitor, they do have to pay for it. They could get a job and pay their own rent, pay for their ankle monitor, and also start paying back their restitution and their fines. Not only that, they are not just sitting in jail doing nothing, and then they could have more opportunities to have access to treatment services outside the facility because there's not a broader option. On an individual that I live with right now, the parole board released him to my house and he is on ankle monitor. He relapsed and they violated his probation. And then the parole board let him out. And he is a tax-paying citizen. He struggles with addiction issues. And he's a nonviolent offender. He had drug charges. His first He started using drugs in jail, I'll just tell you that. And he's been fighting a 15-year heroin addiction. And he's in his mid-30s right now. So there's a lot of things that play into what the commissioner and DOC is doing, and we are talking about nonviolent offenders and violent offenders. The individual accused of my son's murder is a violent offender. I'm a nonviolent offender. I could have benefited from going onto an ankle monitor. But before all that happened, what are we doing as a state to prevent this from happening? Individuals like myself that needed to get help, we're so behind, as far as Alaska goes, we are so behind in times as far as our resources for treatment services and detox. On October 2nd, I went down to Washington, D.C. for a national gathering called Unite to Face Addiction. And if you want to check out the website, it's called facingaddiction.org. And I met with three of our senators in Washington, D.C. My son's picture is in every single senator's office that we met with, and it was 6 felons, 1 misdemeanor, and a mother of an addict that attended this from Alaska. And I learned a lot, and I think that we should start getting on board with what other states are doing in order for us to have a better successful reentry for inmates.
Thank you for your courageous and sorry for your loss. Prayers and comfort are with you, and good job on your battle with recovery. And keep up the good work and your courage to speak out. I think it's you have a lot of insight that we as policy setters and the public need to hear about. And now these are difficult issues, but I think what you've hit on is that unless we stop the cycle, it just continues, and it's multi-generational.
Yes.
Thank you. Next we have, I don't have a name, but who's here from Pioneer Peak Monitoring?
Good afternoon. I'm only going to use a small portion of the time.
Yeah, if you state your name, please.
Daryl Jones. I'm counsel for Pioneer Peak Monitoring. I'm a defense attorney. I'm a prior sexual assault counselor for Department of Corrections back in the early 80s. My condolences to the woman that was just up here. I can tell you, first off, that he was not admitted to an electronic monitoring program to be released. As far as we know, he's still incarcerated. And that's the way it should work. I have not been here for the vast amount of people talking, so I'm kind of in the blind to a large degree. But the process is complex. As a sexual assault counselor in the 80s, you had a feel for who was going to come back, who was not. As a defense attorney since 1988, I'd seen many of the people in the early 80s revolve in and out of the courthouse, sitting in hearings that I was in. The issue of rehab is very complex. The advantages, like I said, I'm not sure what the objections were to electronic monitoring, what the testimony's been, but I can tell you the advantages of electronic monitoring are numerous. Pre-trial monitoring allows for somebody that has indicated a nonviolent offender to get out. And what it allows me to do as a defense attorney is set them up in a situation where, as part of the bail conditions around electronic monitoring, they're watched constantly electronically, which is far more reliable, notwithstanding what anybody says, than a third party. Third parties, you can drink behind their back. You can leave before they find out. There's a variety of things that can happen with a live third party that you can't fool an electronic monitoring company. So that's one advantage. The other thing it does, it allows us, as if you're a good defense attorney, to incorporate treatment. Drug and alcohol assessment on the front side of this, rather than relying on a system that's overburdened, and if you build the jails, they will come. You'll fill them as we filled everyone quickly. It allows us as defense attorneys to get a lot of this stuff in the works before they're sentenced. So that's an incentive, because they get credit if they don't violate and adhere to the terms specified by the statute. They get credit for the time served. It's a good thing to have. Everyone talks about implementing treatment programs in jail and doing this and that, but what they don't want to do is pay the money. And that's the reality of it. These programs cost an extensive amount of money. If we can achieve the same results on the outside, then we're sitting in a far better position.
Thank you, Joe.
Okay. So I'm going to defer to...
Okay. C.J. Allison?
Maybe I wasn't speaking clearly. I was just speaking of the kind of the first half, because Pioneer Peak's in the back. I'm just corporate counsel. That's why I said I'd defer some of my time to her.
Okay. State your name, please.
My name is C.J. Allison. I'm a resident of Wasilla. Thank you for the opportunity to speak. I'll try to fit a lot into a very little amount of time. I would echo a lot of the comments that I've heard from other community members throughout the day, in that one of the biggest problems with the evaluation of judicial reform right now is that there is no voice from the community built in to be able to provide context to you on what the ideas are that are coming forward, our experience with those ideas. I think that there are some good ideas coming forward with Senate Bill 91 and such things, but a lot of those are the equivalent of trying to do some kind of topical treatment for cancer. My frank belief is the Department of Corrections is inheriting a problem that is starting long before the inmate arrives at the Department of Corrections. I am an individual. My husband was recently sentenced in February and remanded from court and is on a 40-year sentence with 10 suspended. I would challenge the commissioner, if you're looking at people to release early, to look at anyone in the state who is currently convicted or accused of a shaken baby syndrome charge. It is a crime that has come under intense scrutiny worldwide in the medical community. And if you look at the research, if you look at the information, if you look at the content of those cases, the reality is that it is impossible to convict someone of that charge beyond a reasonable doubt when there is literal worldwide argument going on for medical professionals across the country and across the world over whether or not that syndrome is even real. These individuals are accused of violent crimes. They are convicted of what's considered a violent crime. But in most cases, it is not even a question in the courtroom of whether they're a danger to the community. It's stated that they're not. So that would be one challenge that I would have, is to look into those situations that are all across the country. It is not a small, isolated issue. There are over 1,200 people a year convicted of this issue across the United States, and over 200 to 300 of them have been released in the last 2 to 3 years alone based on the unscientific nature of the evidence against them. I would also say that I have a lot of input that I would like to be able to provide as far as victims' rights and communities' rights and families' rights. One of the biggest things that I've experienced within the system is that I was a victim in this case. I was the only statutory considered victim. And when I pled for help, I was turned away by the court. I was turned away when I said, I have a prosecutor and a judge that are lying about me, and I'm not a defendant, so I'm not allowed to tell you that they're lying about me on stand. And I was told, you don't matter because you don't agree with the prosecutor.
Can you please summarize? Thank you.
So I have a lot of feedback that a large group of us would like to provide. We have a large group of Free Clayton Allison supporters across the state who are gathering information on the flaws with the justice system and the lack of accountability of all the professionals involved.
Thank you. Rupert Vaughn and then Johnny Murdoch. Robert Vaughn, excuse me.
Thank you. I don't write very well. My name is Robert Vaughn, and I am CJ's father. And what I'd like to bring out today, crucial thing, is that one of the problems that I see with our growing prison population that is not being looked at is, for people who know how to play the system, they simply get a plea bargain and they get a couple of years. If you are brave enough to stand up and say, no, I did not commit this crime, and you go to trial, you can expect a lengthy system. Clayton Allison was offered a 2-year plea bargain. He turned it down because he wasn't willing to say that he hurt his daughter. And I know he didn't. I spent years with him on third party. He did not leave my side. He obeyed every rule of the court. And even though the court said that he is not a danger to society, the community insists that he get 30 years. It was actually 40 with 10 suspended. And I think we need to take a look at where this is starting. Right now, prosecutors and judges have no accountability. There is seemingly, because we have tried, there is no one that can touch them. They are free to say what they want to in court, and nobody challenges it. I agree. We want justice. There are people that need to serve time. They have done horrible things, and they need to serve time for it. But we also need to not put those people away with lies, or all we are doing is perpetuating the system. All we are doing is saying, look, we won because we cheated. We want to give people good examples. Let's set it at the beginning. I think that's all I have to say.
Sure. Thank you. Johnny Murdoch? I also want to recognize that we have a Palmer Mayor Johnson here. We had Mayor Cottle from Wasilla. I think he's just stepped out. Assemblymember Jim Sykes and Sarah Heath with the Governor's Office. And thank you, Sarah, for coming and listening. Appreciate that.
Name is Johnny Murdoch. I was the training officer for the Mat-Su Bureau for some 23 years, retired assistant chief, spent 38 years now in the fire service. I have come back since I retired as the IC for the flood up in Talkeetna a few years ago and got to play as plans chief on the Sockeye Fire until the Type 1 team showed up. So been here a long time, been involved. 38 years ago in another city in another state, I took an oath to protect the public. And quite frankly, I think several people in Juneau have forgotten that as public servants, that is supposed to be our highest goal. When I hear the commissioner talk about someone in the governor's office and the legislative leader's office setting targets for cuts and reduction without any public input or concern for what those cuts may do to the public, except for this type of committee hearing, I get rather incensed. I guarantee you last year, if the citizens of this state had been asked, do we want to see 28 troopers cut statewide, we would have said no resoundingly. Yet we're being told there's probably going to be another 28 next year. We're getting the shaft. We're getting the shaft by our court system. Certainly there may need to be cuts. There may need to be taxes. There may need to be a lot of things. But a priori decisions that negatively impact the citizens. I have a scanner because I'm still involved. I hear the trooper prioritizing calls every day. I hear felonies not getting responded to in this borough almost every day because there's no one available. And we're talking about more cuts, and that is supposed to serve the public? I don't think so. That's my comment.
Dorette Weeks, she's still here? And then I have one other name I can't read, starts with an E. Okay. Please come forward then, if that was you. Eugene? State your name, please. And 3 minutes, but we're on public safety, so you keep it to that topic, please.
Excuse me? Public comments allows anything, but I'll be brief.
Very brief. My name is Eugene Carl Haberman. I represent myself. I live in the Matanuska Valley. I follow the public process. If the public process is done appropriately, and a decision made by the governing body is more like in the public interest. First thing I would like to say is I thank those members who arranged to have this meeting in this room. I consider this one of the better rooms for a public meeting, and I thank those who are responsible for that. I am concerned about public notice, and one thing is also concerned is this is a significant issue in the community, and when you have meetings during the day, starting at 10 o'clock during the week, how do you expect the public to be here? Because a good part of the borough, people who live in the valley, have commute to Anchorage, and they have to earn their bread and butter every day. So with respect to that, I'm concerned on that. Note it was advertised in a newspaper, in a news story, that this was a town hall meeting. I appreciate Representative Culver's staff, Angie, for clarifying what this is. It's a field hearing, and it's being sponsored by Representative Jim Culver. But when I see other members of the representatives up there, it makes the appearance that all of you are part of a team. But in reality, it's really, this meeting is represented by Jim Culver. And it confuses the public, and one not need to confuse the public. But I stress this thing. I just find it, as many of you know, I attend a lot of meetings, from state meetings to local bodies, borough assembly, and so forth. But if there's any hope for the public, for the governing body to make a more appropriate decision, is to engage the public. And I appreciate if all of you present work more to get that appropriate notice, because it wasn't done for this meeting. Thank you.
Thank you. Anyone else wish to address the issues?
My name is Jim Sykes. I'm an assembly member here in the Mat-Su Borough. I represent District 1, which includes the Matanuska River and the Glen Highway, where the Palmer Correctional Center is located. And so I want to thank everybody, the legislators who came, the people who came from the members of the public, and the people who testified, because it's eliminated a lot of problems, and I think a lot of people are working towards a solution. The questions that I have is, as you go forward as legislators and administration, I hope that you really consider what the effects are on all the communities. The people who are working at the prison, the communities who are going to be affected by the potentially affected by the releases, the opportunities for rehab. And I would ask the question, it used to be, this was years ago, that when you put somebody in prison, the state said they had a responsibility to do rehab while people were in prison. And I did not hear that today. It may still be true, but if you are in prison and you're not being rehabbed, maybe that's an opportunity that we're not seeing. So I wish you the best in sorting all of this out, but I hope that the effects for the victims, for the people who are offenders, the people in the communities, and I know the dollar figure is really uppermost, but if cutting out troopers and closing the minimum security is a dollar thing, I hope that you'll consider the costs of that might be saved in not doing it if it can be restructured and improved. Once again, thank everybody.
Thank you. Anyone else?
Good evening. My name is Robert Basket. I'm a compliance agent for Pioneer Peak Monitoring. It's a private EM company here in Palmer. I just wanted to speak on a couple topics that were brought up earlier today, mainly regarding the public safety and stuff like that. I heard the commissioner of DOC speak earlier talking about the levels of people cutting off and the problems that go along with that. Our numbers would relate to his, where 1% are absconding or things like that, but it's a high success rate. 90% is where we usually are, only 10% violations. Things we would like to see from early release and the new House bill that was just recently passed is closer work with probation and the district attorney's office in the state to promote more public safety. Sorry, I was away doing drug testing a second ago. Currently, we give weekly reports to district attorneys, state's immunities. We work closely with the law enforcement, and we just like to see more of that, where people are released and able to get more time out towards their sentencing. Yeah, that's all I have.
Hey, one question for you.
Yes.
What's your response time for noncompliance with the within the realm of where the year?
It's usually very quick. If it's a failed UA in the office, it's immediate. The alcohol testers are usually within an hour. House, if they break their house arrest, it's usually very quickly, within half hour to an hour, depending on how far away they are. If we don't believe that we can get there in a quick time, almost immediately, then we coordinate with troopers to see if they can give us assistance. but it is usually very quick. We get instant alerts to our phones and other sources.
How many do you have on monitor currently? Pre-trial, right?
Pre-trial, yes. Currently, we have approximately 50 monitors out, but we have a capability to monitor up to 200 people.
How many staff do you have to respond to an incident?
Five currently.
Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Anyone else? Please come forward, state your name.
My name is Heidi Dedman. I'm a member of Stop Valley Thieves. There was a question earlier about court view and how the lack of sentencing information on court view affects the public. We do a lot of community work, obviously, with Stop Valley Thieves. One of the things that I focus on is informing the public or keeping them up to date on judges when it's time to elect judges. There is really no criteria for electing judges. They don't have a political party that is advertised or anything like that. So really all we have to go by is the way that judges are sentencing. And if we can't keep track of the way that judges are sentencing or using the guidelines for sentencing, we really have no way to know whether this judge is effective or not effective or is helpful to the community and what they're doing in their job. So I just wanted to point that out as far as court view sentencing is concerned. Overall, I'd like to talk about costs. Everything really boils down to money, doesn't it? Because the cost for the community for continuing to have to replace items and pay premiums on insurance, those are costs. Costs to continue dealing with recidivism, that's a major cost. Those costs need to be shifted to allow people who do not possess, the majority of them, don't possess life skills. They need to be learning life skills. And like Ms. Overstreet was talking about, the programs that we're putting money into that are not effective, we need to be shifting that money to programs that are effective. We need to be looking at parenting, anger management, relationship skills. We need to be teaching these things and running these types of programs along with rehab while these people are in prison to give them a leg up so that when they get out of prison, they have some skills that they didn't go into prison with, which is one of the reasons they're there to begin with. So when we're talking about costs, we're talking about, we have troopers that have to keep going out and taking statements and tracking these guys down and taking them back to court. Then we have pretrial costs, we have court costs, we have the DA, we have people who have to take time off of work to go to court to testify, besides the fact that they were victimized anyway. So it is all a matter of costs. We need to start looking at where are we effective, where are we not effective, and we need to start spending money where it needs to be spent. We need money for rehab, we need money for life skills, we need money for when they're getting out of the community, like the My House type programs, to get them integrated back into community. Because as a law-abiding citizen, I don't want it to be us and them. I want all of us to be healthy community.
Thank you. Good job on 3 minutes. Who else we have? Okay, well, first I want to thank all of you for showing up today. This has been a really good soundboard for really what's happening in the field. And, these are tough decisions the legislature has to make with this budget shortfall. And for me, it's a matter of setting priorities, and public safety is tops. So we've got to change the conversation to really what's important to keep our communities safe as the top priority. And look for, we're going to be reducing budgets, but, this is an area I think that affects us more than anything else. And the valley in our state was a very livable place. And we have to, like Michelle is working on, we have to start solving some of our own problems. And it's not all going to come from government. And so that's going to be from all of us working together. Our goal today was to, flesh out what electronic monitoring is going to mean, downsizing of the correctional facilities, and what kind of further work needs to be done to evaluate who should be eligible and what the metrics would be to examine. And I think we've got some more work to do on that. What are the acceptable risk levels? Who could qualify? How can we minimize future reoffending? And so I want to thank you for coming, and my colleagues, they had to leave earlier for another event, for showing up today and participating, and the commissioners and their staff members. You know, we did, just FYI, this hearing's been noticed. We put out a press release. It's been in the newspapers, on TV. It's on the legislative website as a hearing we were going to hold today. And so we've properly noticed this activity. If you'd like to submit any further comments, you can email my staff or myself. You can just go to the legislature site, Representative Jim Culver, and there's a link there for emails. And then keep attuned to this issue as we go through the legislative session. We really need more than what happens typically in Juneau and these type of hearings. The legislature only hears from either people that live in Juneau or the departments. And we need much broader information to make good decisions. We need Alaskans participating, and it's difficult with the process. But we do have teleconference and whatnot. And then if there's a hearing coming up that you're active, you're an expert, or very involved in this field, you want to contact the chairman of that committee where the hearing's being held and ask to be available and to call in for invited testimony. Certainly Senator Stoltz would be interested in hearing from those of you that are involved in these issues, so that good legislation can be crafted. And the budget process moves very quickly, January, February. And so that's important then to, you know, get some of these issues out there. So appreciate you showing up today, and we'll just keep working on this and follow through with corrections and public safety so that we can move forward and in the most safe way possible. Thank you. With that, we'll be adjourned at 1 o'clock. Good timing. And I want to thank the borough for making this facility available.